we try to put ourselves in the shoes of the farmers and think of how many interdependent decisions they have to take.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Development economists have spent decades puzzling over why smallholder farmers in sub-Saharan Africa do not adopt better agricultural technologies. Yes, they lack information, they lack credit, they lack access to inputs, but a new paper just published in Econometrica argues there's a bigger and underappreciated problem when we introduce new technologies to try and help farmers. Karen Makor of the Paris School of Economics and Rachid Lajaj of the University of Los Andes are the authors. They both join me now. Well, welcome back to Vox Dev Talks, both of you.
Thanks, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Thanks for having us. Great to see you.
We have covered this topic many times on Vox Dev Talks, but we can never emphasize this enough. How important is it that we do increase yields and profits for farmers in Africa?
We're starting with a great question. The way I think about this, 50% of employment in sub-Saharan Africa is in the agricultural sector. That's up to 2/3 of employment when you take the agro-food sector combined. So increasing profits in that sector is one of the most obvious ways to increase income at a large scale for a large number of people. In addition, because many of those are smallholders, that also has direct implication for food security. Now, agriculture productivity in the region has not only been historically low, as you hinted at in your introduction, but also is under increasing pressures, whether that's from environmental degradation, whether that's climate change, and as we unfortunately are seeing day to day, geopolitical related macroeconomic shocks, whether that's input price shocks or others that are affecting the smallholders we're talking about.
Science has been doing its part, though. It's delivered better crops, better inputs, but results have been disappointing. How much have they underperformed what we might have expected?
Yeah, first, I think it's important to say there is actually an underinvestment in the science and the public research and development that could lead to kind of new technologies, new crops, new input combinations for smallholders in sub-Saharan Africa. That said, science has done its part with the limited resources it had, and arguably that part of the problem lays there. That said, those technologies and innovations resulting from the scientific process, when we look carefully about how many of those are reaching large numbers of farmers, and again, we are talking about large numbers given how important the sector is, time and time again, at the national level, we find very few technologies having been adopted by many different farmers. Some of this is a supply problem, and there is indeed a literature looking at some of those supply constraints. We look at the demand side of the problem and trying to look into the black blocks of the decision-making process that the farmers may go through as they're thinking about using new innovations.
And is that the mystery here, this black box of what's actually going on when farmers are making those decisions?
Yes, we try to put ourselves in the shoes of the farmers and think of how many interdependent decisions they have to take. They have to decide tons of things, from which seeds they use, which fertilizers, which spacing. Maybe they do some crop rotation. Plenty of small and big decisions that they need to take. Some external factors like the weather. They have to make all these decisions and they're interdependent. The best decision in one area depends on what you're doing in other areas. And so really our contribution is to highlight how complex this is. Because it depends on other adjustments, you need to learn while you're adjusting. And so when you want to adopt a new technology that you are not used to, you're getting out of your comfort zone. Maybe you started to develop some good knowledge about some combinations that works okay. And if you want to change one, two, three things, then you have to adjust the rest as well. It's not only the cost about learning how to use this input, it's about how much you have to readjust if you make this change. And this is even more relevant for sustainable agriculture. Because if it was just intensive using more fertilizer, that was okay. I mean, you have to find out how much you should use, perhaps. But think of conservation agriculture, where you might have to combine no-tillage, crop rotation, crop residuals, a lot of practices, each one of these, you have to learn how to do it, then it becomes quite complex to adopt all these practices at once. How do you find a new good equilibrium that works for you?
So we regularly cover programs and experiments which look at one aspect of farming. And I know that those experiments are difficult enough to perform and to estimate the impacts of. This seems to be like a super complicated question to investigate with no quick or easy answers. How on earth do you set up a trial for this?
Let's think of where the idea comes from. At least 10 years ago, Karen and I were in the field trying to measure farmers' skills. And for this, one of the components we tried to measure was farmers' agronomic knowledge. And so we created some questions to ask about this knowledge. And we realized that there is no good answer to many of these questions because it's always dependent on the other things that you do. Just to give you an example, we would work with some agronomists and tell them what typical mistakes they do. And the agronomists would tell us, well, for example, they should only put one seed, but farmers like to put two or three seeds per hole when they plant. Okay, so we ask the farmers, and most of them indeed tell us that they put two or three seeds per hole. But they tell us, no, this is the right thing to do. You shouldn't put one. So we go back to the agronomist and we tell them, but the farmers say we should do this. And the agronomist tells us, no, they're right, because the seeds that they use are not improved seeds. Hence, the germination is lower, the germination rate, and hence they have to put two or three seeds to compensate for this. So it's just a practical example of the number of seeds per hole that you put depends on which kind of seeds you have. And then, for example, the kind of fertilizer that you would want to put depends also on the seeds that you have. So all these things are so interdependent that we felt that the models that we have at this time typically don't do justice to this complexity. So how do we tell better the story? We started to set up these agronomic trials where the farmers would be randomly selected, quite small in area, but they're a great opportunity to learn. The small plot would be divided into six subplots. Think of 5 by 5 meters subplots where you try different combinations of inputs following integrated soil fertility management practices, which is precisely the notion of integrated in the sense that it tends to combine chemical and non-chemical fertilizers or improved seed solutions, different kinds of solutions. And then we followed up the farmers for 5 seasons to see how these learning in the trial would affect what they do in the rest of their plots and their learning and their decisions.
So you've got the farmers that are in the treatment group here. What is their day-to-day experience compared to the control group? What's happening differently? What are they learning?
The farmers in the treatment group had the opportunity, somewhat artificial opportunity in a certain way, to think a little bit like scientists, to compare the treatment and controls. Well, they know it's the same plot, it's the same weather, it's the same management, etc. So that's kind of what the treatment does. We were eager to document the complexity of it. We collected very detailed data about their decision-making on their own plots, their learning, their perceptions about what was going on the trial plots. So the farmers start experimenting. So they start changing their practices on their own plot, aside from the trial plot. And they don't do that just once. They don't kind of just in one season shift to something new and keep on doing that. They keep on varying the combination of different inputs from one season to the next over the 3 seasons of the trial.
And when they're doing this, do their yields and their profits start to go up?
This is one of the most, I guess, surprising and I think intriguing parts of this paper. In the first season, we clearly show that, in fact, profits go down significantly.
Oh.
And so the fact that the profits go down, I think a lot of people that have thought about agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa, they won't be necessarily very surprised about this. The part that is surprising is that despite profits going down, the farmers keep on experimenting, keep on trying to find the right combination. And as they continue to experiment, as they continue to adapt, in parallel, we see that negative profit becoming less over time by the seasons after the trial turning positive.
Yes, because you followed this up over the seasons after the trial. Why did you stick with it like that?
agriculture by nature is an activity that from one year to the next is very different, exactly because it depends on the climate and many different parts of the climate, right? The rainfall at the right moment in the season, temperature. There is also environmental pressures that are different, whether, you know, pest diseases, etc., that differ from season to season. And farmers know that. And so they know that they're learning in a context where these conditions change. And so in order to understand their learning process, we felt that we had to observe this in lots of detail for multiple seasons in a row to understand the decision-making that they were going through. So they keep on experimenting. And indeed, by the time that we've done this for 5 seasons, we do see a subset of farmers that end up having positive profits, another subset that doesn't. Some of that means that these practices probably were not the relevant ones for all the farmers. And by experimenting the different practices and inputs, some of the farmers realize in the process that they're not getting positive signals from the trials and therefore may not get the positive profits. But other farmers, even despite not having profits, are still keeping changing and tweaking on what they're doing. And so both of those things are happening at the same time.
So how much do we know about which farmers are getting the best results and why are they getting better results?
It all depends on what you mean by getting better results. If you think that the purpose of this experimentation is learning, then the high-skilled farmers are getting the better results. Because part of the value added of this work is that we closely track the learning in 2 ways, especially the know-how, how much they seem to know about the right agricultural practices and combinations, and their expected returns from innovations. So theory says both of these should be good factors for long-term adoption. And so we see that the high-skilled farmers clearly learn faster. Both learn, but the high-skilled farmers have a steeper learning curve and they're very quick at learning. They absorb all this knowledge. We also measure experimentation, meaning how frequently you change what you're doing. And so the treatment makes them experiment more, which is really interesting. And hence they learn more and they have this better capacity to learn. But on the other side, we see that they're making more mistakes. So we have some measures of things that the agronomists would say, these are things that you should not do. Perhaps, for example, reusing hybrid seeds over different seasons is not good. We know that you shouldn't do this and that you might do it if you change your seeds, but you haven't changed yet the practice of reusing seeds, which was okay with traditional seeds, for example. So many wrong practices tend to increase over time. So what happens is that as a cost of experimenting more, the high-skilled farmers get more loss at the beginning. Then they tend to all catch up, whereas the low-skilled farmers adopt a bit later, but they benefit from first observing the high-skilled farmers. Hence, they get less losses in their yields and their profits, and then they can, a bit later, adopt without the cost of the, or less cost of experimentation.
It reminds me a little bit about all these books that are written about startup culture, about failing fast, learning by doing, all of these things. Is this the sort of process that farmers are going through during the time that you're observing them? They are learning by doing, even if that means that they have to take some failures.
Yes, exactly. So many of the theoretical models that we have about farmers, the traditional models already assume that sometimes they're willing to take this cost of learning by doing, and I would be willing to get some losses to get some gain in the future. But others would argue that no, farmers are not that sophisticated. They really need to maximize, and because they have to put enough food on the table, they just have to maximize their immediate gains, and that's what they do. And so part of what we find is there is this degree of sophistication in the sense that they think about future periods and they value the learning enough to say, I'm willing to take this loss in order to learn, and I think that it will be worthwhile in the long term. And the high-skilled farmers are even more willing to do so because they know they can learn more. So eventually it's even more worthwhile for them to experiment.
I'm going to ask a question which shows that I've never been a farmer. Why is this so hard to get right?
It's a great question. If you're programming, for example, you can make mistakes and it takes you about 5 seconds, 30 seconds, a minute to realize your mistake and adjust it. For them, each attempt that they do takes them a season. You have to try one different set of combinations. And then if you didn't do it right, first, the costs are real in terms of your own income. And perhaps if you're really at the border of feeding your family, at the limit of being able to feed your family, the costs are real. And then you have to wait another season to try something different. Each trial is very costly. Second, there is what we refer to as this curse of multidimensionality. There are so many dimensions that you have to decide about. It's not as if, okay, I found what's the right quantity of fertilizer. Now let's find what are the right seed. And now let's find what is the right spacing. Because each time you change one dimension, you have to rethink maybe what you were doing there is not ideal anymore. And so that's where the multidimensionality of the decisions makes you need to readjust your decisions all the time. That makes it even more costly. And that's part of the main message of why sometimes we bring a new innovation and that makes it hard. Just to make a bit of a caricature of the standard models we've been learning, it's as if there was one really good technology, think for example, fertilizer, that would have really high returns. And maybe we need the farmer to realize that the returns are high. Perhaps initially they're reluctant to try it because they don't know that it has high returns. Or there is some know-how, but it's typically knowing how to use this input. For example, which quantity you should use of this input. You do have to learn these things, but it seems quite simple. If only the farmers could learn this, they would adopt it and they would be wealthier. We solve the paradox of technology adoption with this. People are aware that it's more complex than this, but what we emphasize in this paper is that really once you put it in context where it's not that there is one great input, is that there are plenty of possible combinations of which many combinations won't work well. You have to find the few combinations that work well enough. So if you have a combination that works decently well, would you be willing to take the jump of trying something completely new, get out of your comfort zone, and as a consequence, you will probably get some losses until you find a new local max on something that works decently? We combine these trials that give us really empirical learning, a close look at how farmers learn, with some kind of theoretical thinking of how we should adjust our theory given what we're observing in the field in this paper.
These high-skilled farmers seem to be the heroes of this story because they're experimenting, they are doing their best, they keep working to try and get it better, but they also suffer those failures. And then other farmers come along, see what works, and copy it. Is there some way to compensate the high-skilled farmers for doing what is really a public service?
First, there is clear evidence that these hero dimension, I like how you put it, yeah, is there in the sense that the low farmers tend to do what the high-skilled farmers with a lag. So there is kind of this leading, this experimenters aspect. We also collect network data and we ask questions about, for example, who influences their decisions the most. And explicitly, we see who the low-skilled farmers are much more likely to pick high-skilled farmers. And high-skilled farmers are also likely to pick high-skilled farmers. So we have more evidence of this positive externality of them taking the risk and the others benefiting from this. It has many implications. One of them is that in some of the literature, sometimes we debate what should high-skilled people born in rural area do? And some of the literature says, well, the high-skilled premium is higher if you go to urban areas because there they will pay you higher for being qualified. If you believe in this kind of externalities that we think we're seeing here, then it might not be the best thing for the smartest people in rural areas going to the cities. And this is something that is very hard to be top down and people coming and saying, this is what you should do. Maybe they should be compensated. Maybe I'm not sure if they should be paid exactly just for being high skilled farmers. But for example, setting up trials that are like demonstration plots so that they can try things and people around see it and they share their learning are a common practice. How do we reduce this cost of experimentation? And so when it is supported, and especially when it is shared, when whatever one tries benefits as much as possible the others, then we start sharing this cost of experimentation. And then each one might have to fine-tune it to their conditions, but we are not bearing as much of the cost of experimentation, each one on our own. I think one of the key lessons from this work in terms of policy implications is how do we find the right balance between some kind of top-down recommendations? What should they be? If you think that people have to make this jump to a different set of production systems, giving some good ideas of what systems tend to work quite well, what areas are worth exploring is the kind of guidance you want. And then perhaps setting up their initiatives like citizen science, where we try to gather everyone's learning experience and to share it again, sort of facilitating this cycle of sharing between farmers. I think that would be super useful. Maybe it's not a direct pay off to the high-skilled farmers, but it would help lower their costs.
Karen, well, you started with this as talking about the increased challenges for farmers all over the world, but certainly in sub-Saharan Africa, from changing conditions. And farming is becoming more knowledge-intensive all over the world as well. Are there policies or interventions that we can do to make sure that this cost of experimentation is minimized?
Yeah, if we recognize that experimentation is going to need to happen even independently of completely new practices, but even given the changes in the climate and the environment, and both the natural environment and the macro environment, experimentation, adaptation is not a choice anymore. One way to think about that is saying, well, is there a way of providing some kind of financial buffer so that people have the space to experiment while they're not sacrificing the food they need to put on the table? So that points to some type of temporary subsidy. I guess you can think of this in the context of climate justice. Our results suggest that this shouldn't be a very temporary deal because it takes actually a couple of years, a couple of seasons to sort this out. And so I think the other part of thinking of this is both more longer term, but potentially also more scalable. How do we get to more farmers that have the ability to experiment and that think like scientists? And so going to the education system, where you may need a different way of preparing for being able to learn from observation, to speed up the learning and the experimentation so that there is not just a few high-skilled farmers the way we define it, but there is a larger set of people that then cumulatively can speed up the learning among themselves. Having people who can sort out the solutions to their own problems at the local level is probably one way of thinking of this big challenge.
That's a fascinating insight into not just what we can do for farmers, what farmers can do for themselves, but how difficult it is to do it. So thank you very much for talking about it.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
The paper, it's in Econometrica 94, number 2. That's a March 2026 publication. It's called The Complexity of Multidimensional Learning in Agriculture. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. So the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, you know what I'm going to say right now. Subscribe, follow us. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, at voxdev.org, where we carry articles about the topics that we feature. And certainly on Vox Dev Talks, we've been doing a lot about agriculture in the last year. If you like what you've been hearing, please tell someone else about us. Leave us a review as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.